My name's Shinchu. I'm the other teacher here. Before Jaku started her series, I had started a series based on a book that I'm reading by Chogyam Trungpa, who was a really well-known Tibetan teacher. He started the organization. It's called Dharma Datu, and I think it might be called something else now. Jaku, do you know?
Shambhala.
Anyway, he was talking about the what are called the four immeasurables, which is loving-kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, which comes from early Buddhism, the early Buddhist teachings. So he's talking about how do we cultivate these qualities. And the four aspects that he brought up were Buddha nature, spiritual friends, confidence, and discriminating awareness. So today I want to talk about Buddha nature. But these four things, Buddha nature would be understanding the nature of reality. It's a way that we talk about how to understand how reality works and what our relationship is to reality. And Jaku talked about Buddha nature, right? Spiritual friends is about relationship. It's about relationship to what we call the Sangha, which is the group, the Buddhist group, those of us who are doing this path together. So it's about this relationship and how this comes forward. It's also about your teachers. Confidence. We all have to have confidence. We have to have confidence in our ability to do the practice. If we don't have confidence, that's a problem. Jaku talked about that as well. And you also talked about spiritual friends. You talked about all of these things, but hopefully I'll have something to say about them that maybe you haven't heard. And also, it's always good to hear everything more than once. Sometimes I think when we do Buddhist teachings, we're basically saying the same thing over and over again. But it's like we hear it, it doesn't take. We hear it a certain way, or we have to hear it a certain number of times, or whatever it is before it finally sinks in for us. We have to be in a certain place. And then the fourth one is discriminating awareness, which is this question of how do we know how to apply what we know? How do we know what that is? So today I'm going to talk about Buddha nature. The way that I'm going to approach this material is from the position of the Soto Zen school. So it's not from the position of Tibetan Buddhism, but the position of Soto Zen, which is a Japanese school, which comes from a Chinese school, and has a Chinese sensibility about the understanding of Buddhism. And I, you know, Jaku, you probably talked about this, but Buddhism, Buddha was born something, what we usually call the Golden Age of Greece, right? Kind of Western parallel, Western events. So we're talking about 5th or 6th century BCE before the Common Era. So that was a very long time ago. And then Mahayana Buddhism, which is a kind of Buddhism, broad category of Buddhism we practice, started at the turn of the millennium. So it would have been the year 100, somewhere in there. Chinese Buddhism, Buddhism started moving to China around 300 or 400 CE, Common Era. And then Dogen was born in 1200. Dogen was born in 1200. So you can see how much time has gone by, how much time people have had to think about this, for one thing, and to kind of form different ways of talking about this. So I'm going to talk about Buddha nature from the perspective that Dogen would. So why do we care about the doctrine of Buddha nature? We care about it because it helps us understand what we call the Bodhisattva path. The Bodhisattva is a being that continues to be reborn because they want to alleviate the suffering of and to see the enlightenment of all beings. And so the Bodhisattva says, well, I'll keep being reborn into each lifetime until all beings are, as we say in English, saved. Okay? So this isn't like a messianic position where we're like out to save the world and or something like that. Buddhism, by and large, does not proselytize. But it's a kind of shorthand for saying, I'm going to stick around until everyone, you know, has alleviated suffering, until suffering is alleviated. So you can imagine, we're talking a lot. We're talking a very long time here, right? because it seems to be in our nature as humans to want to suffer. So it's like there this willingness to stick around, to keep coming back, to always putting the effort into this sort of practice, this bodhisattva practice. So in Soto Zen, we follow the bodhisattva path. That's what we're doing. We're doing the bodhisattva path. Lots of different... Bodhisattva path has been around since the beginning of Buddhism. But in early Buddhism, people didn't think they could be bodhisattvas. So they followed a different path called the Arahat path. So they kind of had a different idea about what they were doing. Now, in Mahayana Buddhism, right, turn of the millennium, this idea that everybody's a bodhisattva, everybody can follow a path. And lots of permutations of this. But anyway, so we're going to talk about this from what's called the position of Buddha nature. So we have the bodhisattva path, and one of the kind of easy ways to talk about the precepts of the bodhisattva is called the pure precepts, which are renounce harm, cultivate good, and actualize good for others. Now, how we do this can be confusing. Right. Not sure how we do that.
Is the recorder on, Shinji?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Not sure how to do that. But that's basically, these are called pure precepts, which means that the 10 precepts break down into do not kill, do not steal, that kind of thing. So we're talking about a kind of basic baseline here about how we want to behave. How to understand how that's enacted in the world is what understanding what Buddha nature is. So Buddha nature is a kind of blueprint, if you will, about understanding how the world is. What is the world from this position? Now, personally, I believe that this blueprint is true. All right, just so you'll know. I mean, I think this is a true statement about the nature of the world. It's not some kind of like made up story that, oh, well, this is a good way and then we'll just discard it, you know, at some point. But this is actually a description of how the world is. And part of Buddha nature is that we have a natural tendency to want to enact Buddha nature, our Buddha nature. Okay, so what is Buddha nature? Essentially, Buddha nature is everything. Buddha nature is everything. So I would say Buddha nature is more like a process rather than a thing. So there is not anything that we can name that is not Buddha nature. In earlier, before, in some of the sutras, when the Mahayana was first developed, they said all beings have Buddha nature. So it would be like something outside of yourself that you can have or you can acquire. And Dogen said, all beings are Buddha nature. So that really kind of shifts the dynamic at this point, because it's like we are that is our essential nature, is the essential nature of a Buddha. And this essential nature of a Buddha is the nature of everything. Everything you can name, everything you can't name, it is impermanence, it is interconnectedness, and it's interpenetration. It has to include things that seem good and things that seem bad, right? Because everything is included in Buddha nature. Dogen said, entire being is the Buddha nature. I call the whole integral entity of entire being, sentient beings. Okay, so he's got two things here that are very important. One is that everything is Buddha nature. Nothing's left out. So I think it's easier in a way to think of it as process. But at the same time, this envelope made out of cloth is Buddha nature. This podium is Buddha nature. You are Buddha nature. Your pets and all animals and bugs and anything, trees, rocks, Buddha nature. And by that very essence of being Buddha nature, it also means that everything is sentient. And I think that's a little harder for us because we think of sentience as some kind of a self-awareness, right? But when Dogen talks about sentience, he's talking about this way in which everything is participating. Everything is making the world. That is the desire, if you will, from this perspective. The desire of everything the desire of a tree is to make the world. It has its own world, in a way, in some sense, but it's also this integrated world that is our world as well. We're always touching points, right? With a tree, it's producing oxygen. Plants produce oxygen, right? They take in carbon dioxide, they produce oxygen. So it's like for us, we can see a direct relationship between our life and the life of a tree. Am I getting this backwards? No. Our life and the life of a tree, right? So we can see the reciprocity happening right there. There's no ambiguity about that. We know that from science. From a Buddhist perspective, that would be true about everything. Not true in the sense of it's doing something for me, right? But true in the sense that everything has intrinsic value. A rock has intrinsic value. We may not understand exactly what that value is. We may not understand it at all. As human beings, we have a tendency to say, you know, what have you done for me today? To everything we run into. You know, what are you going to do for me? And if you can't do something for me, well, forget it. So we're walking along and we pick up a rock and we say, oh, you're pretty. I think I'll take you home with me. I'm going to put you on my altar because you're pretty. So that way, all of a sudden, it becomes like something that enhances our experience. We don't often say to ourselves, well, I think I'll leave the rock here even though it's pretty. Although we're getting better about this. Because, right, people say, don't pick the wildflowers. Don't do this. When you go on a hike, don't do this. Don't leave your trash. No, 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 no. And so we understand more about the environment. And it's because I think for a couple reasons. One, because we understand something about the intrinsic value of an environmental space in and of itself. And also because we understand that as we destroy the environment, we're also destroying ourselves. So there's an altruistic side to it, and there's a side to it that's self-preservation. So this sentience is part of it. Jhanka talked about the doctrine of emptiness, and Buddha nature is essentially restating the doctrine of emptiness. So the doctrine of emptiness says nothing has inherent existence, right? It doesn't mean nothing exists. It means things don't exist separately, right? So we think of ourselves often as existing separately. We kind of function on that level unconsciously, you know, that I'm like a kind of a separate entity that has no relationship. So it's funny because when we're happy and in a relationship, especially with people, right, that we like that person and there seems to be some kind of reciprocity and harmony in that relationship, then all of a sudden we're like a group. You know, now we see the integration. We see that we are not separate. Or we say, well, they're my family. But over here, there are other people that we don't like. And all of a sudden, we're separate from them. They have nothing to do with us. You know, we're like, oh, that's not me. That's not part of me. And then all of a sudden, we inherently exist. We're like not part of it anymore. So this is actually not true. The reality is that we are in relationship with people we don't like, with everything. We're in this deep relationship. And it's not just a relationship in the sense of there's, you know, this kind of like we're going along like this side by side. It's like this. We actually are completely interpenetrating with all beings. So from that perspective, we are one thing. We are one process. Life is one process. So if we talk about people talk, this is not Buddhist, but the idea of Gaia, right? The earth as a living being. So if we think of the earth as Gaia, what are we? I like to say, well, we're like hairs on the head of Gaia. You know, maybe we're like, and hair follicles die and they fall out and they get replaced. And, you know, it's like Gaia's kind of just going along. Hair falls out, no problem. You know, grows back. So this way that we are part of this much bigger process called life that we are completely integrated into. We are not separate from. And in some ways we're not special, right? Because from something else. So in comparison, like I'm not more special than a rock. I'm not more special than a tree. And as human beings, we say, "Oh, I'm separate. I'm the top of the heap here." So this way in which we kind of shift our thinking about the nature of what our place is in the world, that everything has intrinsic value, that everything, even though we don't know what it is, we may not understand what it is, everything's necessary. Everything's included. So part of the Bodhisattva path is like, we'll say, well, how? How is that? What is that? What does it mean to say everything's included? What might it be to be a rock? Right? What is the intrinsic value of a rock? I don't know that I can't definitively say what that is. This is part of the question. I personally can't definitively say what it is, but I don't think any of us can definitively say what it is. But it is, and that isness has intrinsic value. That isness is helping the world make the world. Dogen likes to take nouns and turn them into verbs. So it's the world worlding the world. So if I say the world worlding the world, it takes out the me right in there. Because I'm also the world worlding the world. The rock is the world worlding the world. Everything is worlding the world, making this world that I live in. And everything is intrinsically and importantly and integrally part of that world. And that world is completely interpenetrated. So we have two aspects. We have the aspect of our individual aspect, because Buddhism does not deny our individuality. We call our particularity. And at the same time, there's this universal aspect as well. So we can see it as this universal whole. And we're also individual. There is this individuality in that. We do have rocks, tables, trees, us. We do have friends. We do have people that we don't like. There are cars. If you walk out in front of a car, and you get hit, it's ouch, right? It's not like it doesn't exist. It's a real thing, and it just ran into us, and call an ambulance. So this is not denying this aspect. To say that things don't have inherent existence means that things are completely interconnected. It means things completely interpenetrate each other. Sitting in this room together, we're all breathing the same air, which means that we really are physically interpenetrated with each other in a space. Like we've already. You've probably breathed in my air, and I breathed in yours, and it's gone into a cellular level. So in that way, we are completely connected with each other. So on a cellular level, from spending this time with each other. This complete interpenetration that happens, whether we want it or not, is happening all the time. This is how the world actually is. So there's this positive language. Buddha nature is a positive language. Jaku talked about this. Apophatic and cataphatic. I never can remember. Cataphatic is the not this, not that.
Apophatic.
Apophatic is like take it away, take it away, take it away. Cataphatic is let's come up with a word and let's call this something. So what we're going to call this is Buddha nature. So it's not a fixed thing. Things are interconnected. Or as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, everything is interbeing. It's a process. So that means that one of the primary qualities of Buddha nature is impermanence. Right? That's another thing we don't like as human beings. We don't usually like impermanence because we think of impermanence in negative terms. We usually don't think of impermanence. Impermanence is actually a neutral word. If we didn't have an impermanence, we couldn't move our arms. All the chemical processes that go on in your body and the whole world, right, that make things move, that change things, that's based on impermanence. There has to be impermanence. Impermanence is just an interactive event. It just means that nothing's static. Nothing has inherent existence. Everything is interrelated, interconnecting, interpenetrating, running together, making the world. And that's impermanence. The thing for us is that impermanence for us usually means I just lost something that I want. Usually that's how we think about impermanence. So when we think about impermanence that way, it's suffering. And the truth is that if somebody we love dies, that's impermanence, right? Somebody we love, that fixed relationship that we had in our mind with that person, this very specific way, well, this relationship with this person is about hugging them, or it's about talking to them, it's about having dinner with them, it's about doing this, it's about doing that. So we have this very fixed idea about what that relationship is, and then all of a sudden it starts to change. They're dying, something's happened, they've been in a plane that's disappeared, and we don't know what happened to them, and it's like, it's this devastating, horrible example of impermanence. And yet, if we can deeply understand the nature of impermanence, accept and see that impermanence is necessary, impermanence is the world itself, I think it helps us come to a kind of way that we can relate to that, that has a little more sanity to it. It doesn't mean that we're not going to suffer when somebody that we love dies. It doesn't mean that we're not going to suffer when we get laid off from our job. It doesn't mean that we're not going to have these feelings. So Buddhism, Soto Zen Buddhism, is not about cutting off your feelings. It's not about saying, oh, I'm not going to suffer because I understand impermanence. But the more we come to understand the nature of impermanence as this entity and event that is happening all the time in our lives and the necessity of it and that it is reality itself, then the more equanimity we're going to have. I can't give you a prescription right now about, you know, well, if you do this thing, then this isn't going to happen. You're going to be protected from ever suffering. But this way that we find more equanimity in our lives by observing and being aware of and working with the things that we can work with that are things that are less devastating in our lives, that we notice and see impermanence. We see the beauty of impermanence. When we go up into the mountains and we look and see this gorgeous vista, that's impermanence. How did a valley get there? You know, how did a mountain happen? Because it's impermanence expressing itself. It's the world worlding the world, happening right now. So this is Buddha nature. It's dynamic. It's intimate. It's this connection. It's our life. So, seeing this dynamic, understanding this interconnection, is the genesis of compassion and empathy. When we see that we're all in this world together, we feel this empathy. So, you know the difference between pity and empathy. Pity is like, I'm up here, you're down here. So pity is not such a helpful thing. Empathy, compassion, is like this equality. So there's not a, if you will, a power imbalance in it. Compassion means passion with, right? So that this way that you empathize with, this understanding that we're all in this together. Jaku said to me the other day, we were watching, I'm very interested in this plane disappearing. I think I was watching CNN. And Jaku said, it's interesting, nobody's talking about the fact that there are all these people, the families of all these people who are, who've disappeared in this plane and how devastating it must be. You know, they're all holed up in a hotel. You know, in Malaysia, I can't imagine the level of suffering that's just in the air, you know. And she was saying, you know, this is empathy. This is this empathic side to go to that place of saying, well, what about those people? Instead of just, it's like an intellectual puzzle. You know, on CNN, it's like everybody's speculating, have 1,000 theories about what happened to this plane. So there's this human element, this, I don't want to use the word human, there's this interconnection, this vibrancy, this intimacy element that comes forward when we think about it from that perspective, when we feel empathy, we feel that suffering. We don't have to wallow in the suffering, but to feel that suffering creates this kind of compassion and awareness that comes from seeing the interconnection that we have with each other, the interconnection that we have with everything. Maybe it's a little harder to feel empathy for a rock. You know, we don't know if we pick up a rock and throw it across the street what it feels like. Maybe rocks, you know, don't go boom, 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 you know, as it goes, it skips across the pavement like, ouch, ooh, ah. Maybe that's the value of cartoons, right? Because rocks have voices in cartoons. So this the, we don't know what that is, but it might be interesting to ask yourself about that. It might be interesting to say, what is life like from a rock's side? You know, what is this sentience that's happening here in this moment, in this thing that I can pick up? So those are questions to ask. So this is where this kind of grounding in this worldview is where our compassion is. And of course, this kind of thing is not the, you know, the total purview of Buddhism. You know, all of us feel this. All beings feel this with each other. It's not like it's some kind of like Buddhism figured this out. But this is this is the doctrine or the way or the foundation of what it is that we're looking for, what it is that we're trying to see, to ask ourselves about. What is the nature of this? How does this work? Is this, how does my life work this way? So out of this kind of dynamic comes kindness, compassion, joy. Joy can come from this. There's a word that's English word that's used in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, and the word is disporting oneself in emptiness. I love this word, disporting oneself, to play in emptiness. Sort of like I think what surfing must be like. I'm not a surfer, but it's like this way that we play in the waves. We feel this dynamic intimacy of the ocean. We disport ourselves in our world. This curiosity. What is this? But in this way that brings forth a kind of joy of discovery. An interest in impermanence. An interest in this connection. Maybe even a little laughter. Somebody told me the other day, they said, well, everybody's so dour in Zen. It's true.
In the Zendo.
In the Zendo. The
formal practice.
There is some truth to that. Can I say? Remember when I was at Tassajara, Cindy Lauper was doing Girls Just Want to Have Fun. And I remember the video for that was like she was running upstairs at her parents' house or something. She must have been, I don't know, running upstairs, like jumping on the bed or whatever, saying, Girls Just Want to Have Fun, you know. I thought, that's good. We need that energy. We need that. We just want to have fun energy, you know.
It's kind of funny how we think that's funny, though.
What's funny?
That we're so dour.
Well, I think it's good to laugh at oneself. You know, to hold both of those things simultaneously. To be serious and at the same time to be able to laugh at ourselves.
Yeah, I recognized it mostly when we were saying that. Because it seems, not like we're singing it or... Yeah. Like, have this nice voice.
Maybe when you take all the sounds of the world together, maybe what you end up with is this kind of chant like this. When all those sounds go together. But can I see this for a second?
Sure.
You know, it's traditional in Buddhism to dedicate a book when you write a book, or dedicate a lecture, or to give away the merit of the activity that you're engaged in to all beings, to say, I don't want to hold on to any of the merit that might be generated from this activity. And I also want to acknowledge that this world, this teaching, is unsurpassable. It's penetrating and perfect Dharma. So for me, when I read that, I go, oh, that makes me happy. It does make me happy. I think to myself, you know, this is like unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect. What is that, to be unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect? And not only that, it's rarely met with in 100,000 million kalpas. Yet we give lectures every Saturday. And not only do we give lectures every Saturday, but you can bet that there are people giving lectures all the time, all over the world, right? But it's so interesting, because there's another side of this where it's like, as human beings, it's so hard for us to actually meet this. It's so hard for us to actually experience this in a certain way, even though we experience it all the time, 24/7, because we are Buddha nature. How could we not be experiencing this? This is life itself arising. And so we will experience this, because this is what we are. We are not separate from this. So it's like, it's this interesting koan, because it's happening all the time. It's like, bang, 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 breath, life, sounds, being, impermanence happening all the time, interpenetrating, unsurpassed, perfect Dharma. And we're like, whoa, where is it? Where is it?
That's what's funny. We keep trying. We're there, but we keep trying to get there. But
yeah, and the reason we keep trying to get there is because that's our essential nature. We deeply, from a Buddhist perspective, we deeply understand that that's our true nature. And because that's our true nature, we resonate with that. We want to move towards that. Although it's not outside of ourselves, but we kind of think it is. So it's this way in which we practice, we do this practice, not because we're trying to get something, even though we think we are trying to get something. We do the practice because it's actually an expression of who we already are. It's an expression of Buddha nature, who we already are, what we already are. All beings are Buddha nature. All beings, sentient beings. So we are compelled. We are compelled to go forward and practice this practice.
Maybe that's what felt so good to me, that moment of spontaneous laughter. Mm. It was like a moment of shared connectedness with that Buddha nature.
Yeah, for me, it wasn't.
So just a second, you guys. I would like to finish my lecture. So this way in which everything is making the world together, this making the world together, is Buddha nature. So part of this too is what Dogen calls continuous practice. So this continuous practice is this making the world, again, that everything's involved in. So he says, when we cause even the mountains, rivers, and the earth, and the sun, moon, and stars to do practice, the mountains, rivers, and the earth, and the sun, moon, and the stars in their turn make us do practice. So he almost always does this. He'll start out with making a kind of sound like we're doing some kind of activity, that we're driving the activity, that our effort to do practice is driving the activity. And then immediately he comes back and says, and the activity is driven by the practice of others. So it isn't just about our activity, it's about meeting the activity of the whole world. Dogen says in Genja Koan again, to carry this self forward is delusion, to allow myriad things to come forward is realization. To allow the mountains and the stars and the rivers to come forward and meet us, to allow our friends to come forward and meet us, to allow our enemies to come forward and meet us, to allow everything to come forward and meet us is this effort that we're making in continuous practice to meet our life. So it's a kind of reciprocal event, right? That is happening on this multidimensional way. It's like a complete hologram. You know, in a hologram, one part of the hologram is the whole. So it's the same thing, this one part that we see with our perceptions, with our minds, whatever, is also making the whole, and the whole is making us. So these things are happening simultaneously. They're not sequential. They're not like this and this and this and this and this. It's this complete process. So he says, when we cause even the mountains, rivers, and the earth, the sun, moon, and stars to do practice, mountains, rivers, and the earth, the sun, the moon, and the stars, in their turn, make us do practice. You could say the mountains, the rivers, the earth, the sun, the moon is Buddha nature, and that continuous practice of Buddha nature is why we practice Buddha nature, because we are Buddha nature. Does that make sense? This way that it completely drives, like a perpetual motion machine of practice. The more we do it, the more it keeps happening. The more you engage in, it's like when you go out and you're at the store and somebody's really does something nice for you and you feel happy, right? You want to reciprocate. So then you reciprocate to somebody else. You hold the door for somebody else. I have a friend who said to me the other day, I was talking to her, and she said, I think I talked about this on Tuesday night, she said, I don't like people who are rude. And I said, oh, well, what's a rude person? Well, a rude person would be somebody for whom I open the door and they don't say thank you. So there's a way in which, for her, the practice stops. It's like she does this altruistic action of opening the door, but the person doesn't say thank you, and so, bang, that's it. I said, well, I talked to her a little bit about, well, you know, you don't know where that person's coming from, what's going on in their mind, you know, maybe blah, 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 but it's having an effect. And then she said, well, I'll just stop opening doors for people. Right? This way of just saying, okay, well, I'm not getting the response that I want in this situation, so I'm going to, like, stop doing it.
And perpetuate their behavior.
Well, and perpetuate your own unskillfulness. We don't have to worry about their behavior. That's the other thing about the Bodhisattva path. It's about cultivating our own, cultivating who we are. Transformation within the self. Taking responsibility for our own actions. You know, and creating a kind of empathy for the other. This doesn't mean people get to run over you. It doesn't mean, you know, that people can abuse other people. It just means that you know, her desire to open a door for somebody should not be predicated on whether or not that person says thank you, right? It's like our desire to do good, our desire to enact the Bodhisattva path, to enact Buddha nature, that desire to do that comes strictly from us. It comes from us seeing the totality of this and our part in this. So it's not about having a preconceived idea about what the other person is supposed to do in response to what we do. You know? We don't know what's going on for that other person. Maybe that other person's just lost their job and they're completely preoccupied by that. And so you say, I'm never going to open a door for anybody again because that person didn't respond in this moment the way I wanted them to. What have you done for me today? Right? So this way that we drop that, we just let it go. The right thing to do is to open the door. Period. End of story. Open the door. Let it go. Go to the next thing. That's all. No problem. So this is a real way that we cause the mountains to practice and the mountains cause us to practice. The other thing I wanted to talk about is the issue of good and bad. What is good? What is bad? On one level, from the position of Buddha nature, there really isn't good and bad, right? There, things just are. The world is just is. And so the things that we consider to be good and bad in some ways are just things arising, right? And yet there is good and bad. There are things that are skillful and unskillful. There are things that cause suffering. And usually it's associated with human beings. I don't know if this is because we're so human-centric, you know, so we think of ourselves only in the context of our community, or the fact that I don't know what it is. Like I said, I don't know what it is to be a rock. So I don't know what a mountain feels when it's suddenly all hell breaks loose and you know, all of a sudden there's a volcano goes off or something. Is that evil? Because from our human point of view, we don't say, no, that's not evil, it's an act of nature. You know, our insurance policies, it's an act of nature. So that it just is. We don't have these kind of associations with it. Dogen says something interesting. He says, wrongs are realized as having become completely the same as not committing. Aided by this realization, we can penetrate the not committing of wrongs. We can realize it decisively by sitting. So let me tell you what he's saying here. He's saying that when we enact the Bodhisattva path, when we understand and enact Buddha nature, when we are able to actualize our understanding of Buddha nature, it's not an intellectual idea. How could we commit wrong? We would not be committing something that was wrong because we would be completely integrated into the situation, and so our response would be automatically skillful. One way to talk about the Bodhisattva precepts, you say, you know, the Bodhisattva does not steal, right, for example. Another way to say that would be, in the mind of the Bodhisattva, there is no stealing. Which is to say that for somebody engaged in the Bodhisattva way, who's, you know, really adept at this, it just would never occur to them to steal. It just would not be part of their mindset to steal. That's different than that sort of, I have an admonition, I'm not going to do this thing. Like, I go to a store and there's something I want and I don't have any money, so I have to sit and struggle with myself about not stealing it. And then there's the level of, and I think most of us are probably in this category, we go to a store, we don't have the money or we want something, we don't have the thought to steal it, right? We might have other thoughts, like, can I put this on my credit card, or, you know, can I get this money somewhere, or whatever, but it doesn't occur to us as a kind of thought of, to steal it. So this is this way of when we can integrate ourselves fully into and embody what is we already are, this completely interconnected life, that we would not have the thought of committing wrongs. So Dogen said, wrongs are realized as having been completely the same as not committing. Aided by this realization, we can penetrate the not committing of wrongs, and we can realize it decisively by sitting. So he's saying we realize this by sitting zazen. He's talking about formally sitting zazen. To formally sit zazen is to sit down and allow the world to come forth and meet you. Ideally, that's what we're doing when we're sitting zazen. We're sitting, we're meditating, allowing the world to come forth and meet us. Our life, Dogen also says in the Fukan Sesengi, zazen is not about standing or lying or sitting down. It's not about a position of the body. It's about a position of the way we view the nature of our experience. Sometimes it's easier to sit down and have that experience because we're in a calmer environment, right? Our minds calm themselves, our body's not moving around. It's much harder to wake up when you're in the midst of crises, right? It's much harder to remember and find equanimity when you're just being completely bombarded by things. But ideally, that's what we're working towards, right? We're working towards, this is like our whole life. This is everything in our life. Nothing's left out. we are actualizing Buddha nature in our life. And because it is all, it is life itself, he says, what are you waiting for? Often we say, well, I'll do this practice when this happens. I'll do this practice when I can go to the monastery. I'll do this practice when, I don't know, there's a total eclipse of the sun. You know. I'm waiting for something to happen. And he says, if the time arrives, is the time right now. You can't get away from it. It's the time right now. Somebody said to me once, well, I know what the right thing is to do, but I don't want to do it. Right? I'm waiting for the right time for my something, myself, my resistances to break down. Something's going to happen, and then I'll do what I know is the right thing to do. But actually, what we want to do is do the right thing, not wait for the time to arrive. And that's the hard part about practice. That's the tough part about it, is actually enacting it. But it helps to have a kind of map in your head about what it is. It helps because you can say to yourself, I don't feel very interconnected with this person. You know, I'm having an argument with them, so how can I, like, can I connect with that somehow? Can I remember that about this? Is that so? What is that? How does that work? So it kind of opens up, clears a little spaciousness, makes it a little more spacious for us to enter into it. So he said, Dogen said, to say if the time arrives means the time has already arrived. What is there to doubt? Dogen's very, okay, get with it, kids. You know, do the practice right now. All right, I think I'll stop. You guys, you want to
see? Oh, I was just saying that it wasn't the words as much as just the tone.
Yeah. Well, that's the Soto Zen style. Yeah. It's very...
Because when you were saying it, you had a little... There was this little softness in your voice and when you were reading it.
Yeah.
Not when you were doing it.
Right. Yeah. Soto Zen chanting is very monochromatic. I think... I'm not sure where the style comes from, but some people complain. They say, oh, you know, it's like, it'd be so much more fun to sing it, it'd be so much more fun to do this and all that. The Tibetans, you know, they're like, and the Vajra sword, it comes down, and the, you know, it's like and all these pyrotechnics and while you're chanting. But there's something to be said for this. And also in Soto Zen chanting, you don't stop for sentences, you don't stop for periods or things like that, so there's no punctuation. There's something to be said for that in a way, I think, of just a feeling I have about it, that it's not being attached to anything. It's not wanting to make it special. It's like we, you know, when we read something, we want to read it with feeling, right? We want to, like, you know, like I was, an unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect. You know? Yeah. And but it's like, we're like, no, it's not special. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect dharma was rarely met with even in 100,000 million. You know, it's like, we're like, okay, nothing special. It's just Buddha nature doing its thing. That's all.
It reminded me a little, Jack, of the story you told, I think it was of your friend who liked to stay in the back. Oh. And then found herself in the front, couldn't leave, and okay, I'm going to go through these motions and I'm going to do it, but look at this, is so funny. I'm doing what I need to do, and it's really serious, and it's funny that it's so serious.
Yeah.
Just that dichotomy, I thought was
yeah,
strange.
Yeah, but that's our life, right? That's our life. It's like we want it to be this or that. We really do. We want to fix things in a box, you know, and say, because then we can kind of open it up and go, oh yeah, I understand you. Pew! You know, next. But actually it's not like that. There isn't any this or that. It's like good and bad. You know, what Dogen's talking about, good and bad, he's saying, you know, ultimately, in some ways, how do you know something's good and how do you know something's bad? We can say we have rules, like the Ten Commandments. We can say, you know, I won't steal, I won't gossip, let's say, I won't kill. But from a Buddhist perspective, those admonitions are very much part of the tradition. But there are ways to help us ask the question, what is it? What is appropriate in this situation? Maybe there's a situation where it's appropriate to steal. Maybe there is. But we can't discern that. This is this part about discerning wisdom. We can't discern that until we're in the situation. And also, we have to have a deep foundation of understanding about the nature of our life. Really deep understanding in order to make that discerning wisdom, right? So there's that caveat too. It isn't just that, because we have to really be able to know what is this about? Is this about a kind of clinging, a selfishness on my part? Or is this really an enactment of meeting the totality, total aspect of the situation, everything that's arising? When we can do that, again, we don't have to think good, bad. We're just responding to what is appropriate. And sometimes we do that all the time. Like I've talked about before, we're driving our car, somebody pulls in front of us, we just let them in, we don't get angry, we don't get upset. That's just Buddha nature. That's just enlightened response. That's an enlightened response. That's what Buddhas do. And then 3 minutes later, something else happens and we're like shooting somebody the finger or honking the horn, Okay, that's not enlightened activity. That's unskillful and creates suffering for self and others, at very minimum for self. So how do we know? That's what our practice is, how, trying to discern what that is. Tom, were you going to ask a question?
Yes. I really like the part about mountains and rivers and mm-hmm. the sun and moon coming forward. And I can really relate to that. But my question is, everything is Buddha nature, right? So what about Monsanto and GMOs and
same thing.
Groundwater pollution? And
same thing. You can't leave anything out.
So how could you say a little bit more about that?
Are they good or bad?
Well, I don't think you can say globally, Monsanto is good or bad. We're picking and choosing, essentially. It's in the situation that arises. So I'll just say this. It's like, okay, so they do GMO, right? If none of us bought GMO products, it might put them out of business. We are in this interconnected relationship. There's always going to be things that we're saying are bad, but maybe people might say GMO products, is what Monsanto says, allows people in countries that don't have certain kinds of agricultural sophistication or something to be able to have food. It's complicated, Tom. I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that it's like a koan for us, because the teaching says that everything is included in Buddha nature. Everything. So what is that? Because Buddha nature itself is just things as it is. We want to say things as it is good. Right? Buddha nature is things as it is. So things as it is includes GMO, includes these places. It includes Hitler and Pol Pot and Stalin.
There's an interesting complication to that that shows just how complex it is. We saw a story last night where a man claimed that these advances in fertilizer and plantings has allowed the world to feed many, many more millions of people. And that's the source of why we've had such a population explosion in the last 100 years. But it's not sustainable. Our planet isn't designed to sustain the 7 billion people that it now has. And we went from 2 billion people to 7 billion people in the last 100 years because of these advances in how much food we can grow. So was that a good thing to be able to feed all these people that has created all these extra people that now we might not be able to sustain?
It's just things as it is. Randy, were you going to say something?
Yes, thanks. You had talked about the missing plane. And that's how the headlines have presented it. And I don't think anybody is concerned about an airplane. I think they're concerned about people and maybe politics and mm-hmm. but that's not said. And I often think, when I turn on the radio on my way to work, they'll say, injury accident on Highway 17, take another route. And I'm like, you know, there's a human being there whose whole life has turned upside down. And they don't say something like, you know, there's Mary Jones who lived on Main Street and whatever, and she's, you know, we don't expect her to make it. We're going to have a moment of silence for Mary Jones. You know, what is that about with our culture?
Well, I think, you know, I think we can just hold so much, because why don't we have an obituary for everybody that just died while this lecture was happening all over the world? Because how many people, I don't know, they got statistics, right? 10,000 people die, 10 billion people die every minute or something like that. So we can't hold that, you know. But it is happening. This is impermanence. If that didn't happen, life as we know it would not happen, right? But when it happens to us, like you come to mind, you see that on the highway, then you have this whole associated event that happens in your mind around the nature of that. But I wouldn't assume that means that we live in an unempathic culture. I wouldn't assume that.
It's my thought that we've gotten too big to see people as individuals.
Well, I think we've never been able to see people as individuals, because how do we hold all of it? We interact with what meets us, that what we can meet in that moment. Yet, in that meeting, there's always what we cannot see. Right? In the meeting, that meeting includes everything. So I would say, it's, you know, when we meet that, feel the empathy for that. Right? And then drop the rest of it, because I don't think it's particularly helpful. Feel the empathy for that moment and maybe drop the criticism of the moment. And just, this is what I'm meeting in this moment. What is it in this moment? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Holly?
I'm thinking about this topic of Buddha nature, and you know, I don't think that has to lead to a moral relativism where nothing is bad. I think
right.
that instead, you know, I can see some actions as very, very, very unskillful, and I don't want to participate in those actions, and I'd like to speak out about those actions.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, like you said, you just accept there is, for example, greed. Yes, there is definitely greed in the world. There's greed in me. And so you see it less as a us versus them situation, but more as this is part of the human condition. This
yeah.
is Buddha nature.
Yeah. Yeah, that it includes all of this. So, Tom, your example, when we include Buddha nature in that, it means that when we're talking to somebody who espouses that point of view, it doesn't mean that we have to hate them, right? It means that we can meet them with compassion. It doesn't mean that we don't say, I don't want to participate. It doesn't mean that we don't have a rally or something like that. Do you remember, what was the name of that woman down in Florida who was on life support?
Terry Schiavo.
So I remember on TV, they showed the people outside the hospital. And they had like this little corridor that looked like it was about this wide. Right? One side were the people who wanted her to be off of life support, and the other side were the people who wanted her to stay on life support. The hate was palpable. I mean, it was like these two groups of people were like screaming at each other. You know, they had this build this little buffer zone between them. That's not how, from a Buddhist point of view, this is not how this works. You know? Maybe even a better example is one time I was in San Francisco. There was a peace rally down at Civic Center. And San Francisco Zen Center is kind of like a couple blocks from the Civic Center, and it was a major route for where people were funneling off on this rally and doing a march. So people were driving their cars, you know, trying to cross the intersection. So all these people were coming down the street, and they're for peace. I think it was like against one of the wars that we've been engaged in of late. So And the guys who wanted to go across in their cars, people were like slamming their fists on the top of the cars, screaming at the drivers, you know, angry and mad at them about, why don't you get out of your cars? This is peace. Why don't you get out of your cars and participate in peace? You know, like this. And like people are like, I'm just trying to get to work. You know, and they're like, well, this is peace. And so there's this huge negative energy that was coming up because these people were not doing what the peace people thought you should do. And it created a real level of palpable violence, actually. And you got that, I mean, from my point. But so how do we engage in these dialogues with each other that where we can do this in a way that doesn't engender all the suffering and hate? So it isn't that we don't, in this, you know, Holly, as you pointed out, it isn't that we don't respond. And then sometimes there are things that are just clearly not okay. We're not talking about corporations and stuff. We're just talking about our daily life. We're encountering something that's not okay. It's being perpetrated in some ways by what the one of the ways to talk about this from is, which I really love, is to say that when we do things that are unskillful, it's like we're children. It's like we don't understand. If we understood, we wouldn't do this. So if we have the mind of the parent, the best mind of the parent, not the punitive parental mind, but the mind that's with a generous child, generosity, then when we see somebody in a figurative way start to cross the street into traffic, we don't grab them by the neck and beat them up and scream at them, don't go into traffic. We pull them back from the street and say, please, you know, that's not a good idea. I don't want you to get run over. So some way that we have that equanimity, that we can cultivate that equanimity in situations that need to be, like, stopped. Does that make sense? That's what we're going for, is that kind of level of equanimity and wisdom in our responses. It isn't to say that we don't set limits. We do set limits. But how do you do that is the question. Yeah.
I'm thinking about how you describe Buddha nature as a process.
Yeah.
And I think, and I'm thinking about the example of, like, grabbing somebody. I think when we look at things that we find unpleasant, like the Monsanto or those kind of things, that is the thusness, but we have to include the thusness of the reaction to it also. Mm-hmm. So somebody stepping out into a street is Buddha nature, but somebody grabbing them and pulling them back is also Buddha nature. So it's that whole thing.
Yeah.
I think even when we look at things, if we just pick out the things that are unpleasant or just unpleasant, we're missing the two parts. I think it's got to be the thing and the reaction to it is all...
It's all one thing. And when it becomes one thing, it becomes something else, right? So it isn't just this or that. It's things just as they are. It's difficult to express, right? It's difficult to say what that is because language is so kind of, you know, linear. It's hard to say. Dogen expresses it in Chinese Buddhism. It's expressed as mu busho. So mu, which translated means no, right? But it has this quality of going beyond. Go beyond yes and no. Go beyond that, which is just things as they are. Yeah.
So there's different levels of compassion of how evolved you get maybe then? Because like I have something yesterday, I mean, that's the thing about the practice, you start really, things come forth and you realize this is a practice right now. It's happening a lot. And anyway, I had a neighbor who's a very unhappy person and kind of patrols the street, parking, is always involved in things that probably shouldn't be. And we had a little thing where they got very aggressive with me about where I parked. And I didn't know whether just to smile or to, you know, say what I thought. But then I did. And then they came back to me about having my car towed and, you know, all these different things. And it was a silly thing because I just parked in this spot. I have a house, but because we would have company. And anyway, she just... Yeah, I went off about having my car towed and was just this, you know, and I was like, gosh, do you remember that nice thing I did for you the other day when you asked? No, you know. And so I just had to back off. Mm-hmm. But part of me felt like if I just came up to her and gave her a hug and said, are you having a bad day? Mm-hmm. You know, like I didn't continue the mm-hmm. you know, the compassion was pulling back and then just kind of smiling and walking away. But then there was another part of me thought, well, is that really helping them? Because she doesn't get it. So where is my place?
Well, you know, I think you cannot have the expectation that people are going to get it. That's mm-hmm. one thing. It's like we have to drop the idea, not to say, I'm just, if we have the idea that somebody's got to get something, then that can be problematic because we get attached to, you know, I they got to understand what the point is here,
right.
You know.
Exactly.
So we have to let go of that. It's like
exactly.
It's like opening the door and having the person not say thank you.
But maybe
it's,
a hug
you know,
is always a good thing.
Well, or they might smack you. You know, you don't know. Yeah, you don't know what the right thing is to do. I mean, you have to, on one level, you have to be have some intuition about what it is. But in another situation, you know, you have to look at what is my agenda, right? And if I have a heavy agenda in this situation, it's probably better for me to let it go. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, because often when we have an idea about how things should be, we're really attached to that idea. And in a way, that's a kind of aggression to have this attachment to a particular idea, like
even
the person.
Even if it's out of love and compassion?
Well, you need to look at it. If you're really attached to it, the outcome being a certain way, then you really need to look at it.
Because it will continue to happen if maybe that presented itself as a time to...
You don't know. Yeah. You don't know if it's going to keep happening. Ideally, we want to go into every situation with a, I don't know, kind of openness and curiosity about it. I mean, to me, the first question would be, are you parking illegally?
Mm-mm.
Well, okay, so that's good to know. So if she calls the police or whatever, you know, they'll come and the police will come and say to her, you know, well, there's no problem here. And don't worry about it, you know. If you know that you're not doing something illegal, just say, you know, my understanding is I can park here. Thank you very much. Glad you're, you know, keeping up on things and leave. Just, you know, so that's what you can do in that situation. But the thing is to, and it might or something else, but the point is that meet each situation, try to drop your own agenda, be with the situation as it is, and then let go of it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Because when we can't let go of things, we start to get really tight, and we try to control it, and we try to direct it. And that's usually a source of suffering. We're going to suffer because we're not getting what we want, which is this person to respond in a certain way. I can guarantee you you're causing suffering for the other person as well, because they're resisting whatever it is your agenda is, and that's creating suffering for them. You know, they've done studies now that when we get angry, I mean, they've known this for a long time, but when you get angry, you actually create a kind of physical event going on in your body that is very harmful. People who have a tendency to get really angry, like suddenly, you know, that real rage kind of anger, there's like a two-hour window after that where you're really hot, have a high likelihood of having a stroke. So, I mean, there's this real, it's not just a mental suffering. I mean, there's this kind of physical suffering that goes along with of your kind of destruction of your body in a way, you know, that goes along with this attack, this kind of thing about, I've got to get it, meet this way, you know. But if we can open up and actually meet the situation the way it is, then all of a sudden we have all these possibilities opening up about how we can respond to the situation.
Yes.
Thank you. With this practice, sometimes I feel, I know I'm not as skillful yet, so I observe, so I feel fake because, for example, I'm in a situation and I'm trying to act in a non-attached and compassionate way. But then it's not black and white. Then
right.
There's a part that's compassionate, but there's a part that's like, that's not compassionate, that's
yeah.
angry. But then I feel like it's harmful to be angry. But the anger is there and then it's repressed. So I don't know if you have any suggestions of how to deal with it, because it is there. So it's better not to express or to express, but how to express.
Yeah, I think it's better not to express it. And I would say that if you find yourself in that kind of like that situation, if you can walk away from the situation without, if you don't need to do anything, often we think we need to do something when we don't. So if you can walk away from it and then work with yourself, you know. So a way to work with anger is like somebody's done something, you don't like them or whatever it is, and you might, you know, and you, but you don't have to immediately respond, right? It's okay to walk away from it. You just walk away and you say to yourself, you know, how can I find empathy for this person? How can I find connection with this person? How can I realize, you know, that they're suffering? You know, they're having a hard time. It's not like they're just trying to go out here and deliberately mess up my life and make me suffer. It's like, what is their suffering? And you know, you can make up a story as long as you know it's a story. But the idea is that you're creating a kind of equanimity and empathy in yourself. It helps the anger dissipate. Mm-hmm. Often anger comes from this way of, it should be this way, and they're not doing what I think should be. That's actually an attachment to self. That's an attachment to seeing yourself in a certain way, because you say, well, I'm angry about this. Like, say, this person's stealing, and I'm really angry about it. So what does that say? It says to yourself, I don't steal. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm a good person because I don't steal. Therefore, I'm angry because they do. But how about, you know, it's not okay to steal, and I'm not angry about it. How can we find that place? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Just thinking, I think that you can say, I don't appreciate your tone. Your tone is very disrespectful, or something like that, right? Or if I see someone stealing, sometimes I go like that. You know, it's like I saw you. I'm not criticizing you.
Yeah.
But to just let somebody abuse you verbally and walk away, I think that's not helpful. I mean, I think you can.
I don't think you don't have to let
respond
people
to the person and say, this tone is really disrespectful.
Yeah.
It's not inappropriate, your behavior.
Yeah, I think that I think it's important to let people know when you're feeling that way. But you know, now this is just, you know, like what? This is not Buddhist. This is like something that you hear when you go to what I'm about to say. That you hear when you go to these conferences and stuff. It's really important to make I statements. To say, you know, I feel disrespected, or when you say that, I feel such and such, because then you take responsibility for your own feelings. Nobody can make us feel anything. Nobody makes us respond a certain way. Nobody does. It's like we decide. It may be a knee-jerk reaction on our parts, but we're making, somewhere we've made a decision that we're going to respond in a certain way. So nobody can make you feel, you know, disrespected. But you can say, I, you know, this is how I respond to this. This is what this sounds like to me. Then the person may say to you, oh, I'm sorry, that's not what I meant. And then we have to meet them at that moment and say, oh, okay. Right? And not say to them, no, I know you were like, you know, you were messing with me. And say, oh, okay. I guess we had a misunderstanding or something like that. So there's this way of a kind of meeting people when there's a conflict. Allow some space in there where people don't feel like they're being pushed into a corner. How do we respond when we feel pushed into a corner? We get defensive. We get, like, we start to defend ourselves, and then we get aggressive. So how can we kind of, like, make a big field? Suzuki Roshi used to say, you know, you need a big field. Now, kind of implied in that statement was there is a fence. But it was a big field. So if we can give each other a field, that's a level of, that's huge generosity. That's like a real practice of generosity, to allow each other to bang around a little bit. Because we do, we all make mistakes. We all do things that are unskillful and upset other people. So can we give each other that generous response to say, yeah, you know, you're like I am. I make mistakes, so, okay, you get to bang around and make some mistakes here, and I'm going to be try to be generous about it and not try to push you into a corner and actually escalate the situation. You know, does that make sense? Yeah.
So one time I was in the Zen Center in San Francisco, and I remember the story that Rav Endershot told about, I don't remember the exact details, but about eating this, he loves supposedly you white chocolate, and someone gave him a box of candy that wasn't white chocolate, but looked like white chocolate. So he put one in his mouth, and he like, but he couldn't throw away the box. It was this long story about trying again and again. And so this conversation made me think about what my NSA and other people. Like if you really have to do something, and if you're angry and you have to say something to someone, and you do it, pay close attention to how you feel, what happened to the other person. And just made me think that, and then maybe next time you may do it again and again and again until one time you say, that's not the one I want, like, I really don't want to do that, and try something else. And I don't know if that's helpful or not, but that's this little story keeps coming. When
this way in which we're self-aware, we actually feel what's going on in our bodies. Often we don't feel what's going on in our bodies, where we are experiencing suffering, and we're just like kind of like a, when you touch a hot stove, you know, we're just like little amoebas where we do this thing. Except sometimes, you know, in Buddhism we talk about greed, hate, and delusion as a kind of three primary emotions. I would say the primary emotion is fear. Negative emotion is actually fear. Out of fear, we might respond with greed. Out of fear, we might respond with anger. Out of fear, we might respond with this withdrawal, you know, like just kind of completely going dormant. So those are kind of three primary responses. It helps to pay attention to yourself and realize where you go when you get really pushed in. Where do you go? Do you become aggressive, greedy? Doesn't have to be greedy for stuff, you know, but those kind of primary responses. Then when you become aware of that, you start to see how your suffering arises in those places. And it is like a thing of like, I don't want to feel this way. So in that way, it's a kind of intermediate step, because it's not an altruistic response. You're not saying, I want to be generous out of altruism. You say, I want to be generous because this other way, I physically feel, I suffer if I do this. Mm-hmm. So how can we, you know, to become aware of our own suffering when we're being unskillful is quite helpful. And when, as we become more aware of that, we will automatically start transformation. We will automatically start to change. So there's this kind of awareness.
That's where I think the practice of the Zen Center meditation for me has been a big one, because I may not be that skillful yet, but it brings me first to a place of realizing how I'm holding myself, and that my normal mm-hmm. might be have a lot of tension.
Yeah.
And so I'm through that, I've become, when I'm not doing meditation and when I'm walking around, I'm much more aware of how I'm carrying my body and if I'm holding tension, and that draws, you know, that goes into everything, including altercations, you know, and dealing with people.
Yeah, that's a great observation, absolutely. You know, this way that we just stop, you know, and because how we are in Zazen, it's going to say something just about how we are in our life. We don't suddenly become a different person when we sit down on the cushion. You know, it's not like we have all those same kind of thoughts that we have walking around. It's just that, oh, now we're aware of them. So, I completely agree. Yeah.
No, Sue.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sue hasn't said anything on me.
Oh, would you say a little more, too, about the respect for inanimate objects? You know, we've talked a lot about people, but we haven't really talked about how we deal with the things as they're all sentient, too, and have the respect for them.
Yeah, so everything that we work with, you know, has its own intrinsic value. And so we, from an ecological point of view, we continue to help the world make the world by being aware of the value of each thing, not just the value in the sense of what we want it for, but in the sense of it's a whole system that's functioning. And also that just from the perspective of, you know, this striker here has a leather covering on it and some stitching and stuff and lacquer handle. And if I'm going to use this as a tool, there are certain ways that I would work with this as a tool because it becomes part of me, right? So there's that side of it. But it also has its own life, and that I respect that life and use this respectfully. So this may not be a very good example. Say that you have a broom, you know, most of us have brooms. So we talk about storing a broom with a bristle up because that preserves the bristles. It's a kind of respect for the broom. If you store the broom with the bristles down, then the gravity, you know, pushes on them and they get bent and kind of messed up. Maybe they get dirty. So in Zen parlance, the correct way to store a broom would be up like this so that the bristles keep their shape and the gravity doesn't pull them down. And that we would keep our broom clean and that we'd have some place where we stored it. And when we use the broom, we would use the broom respecting its intrinsic value as a broom, you know. So most of the things we're talking about are things that we actually interact with, right? So we're talking about stuff that we interact with, so tools. Or in Zen, if you're doing formal tea, you would always pick a teacup up with two hands. The other thing is that you finish an action. Like when you set something down, you actually set it down. Often we do this. That. Or, you know, like that. It's like we don't actually set things down. We get so far, and it's, I guess, I don't know, it hits our peripheral vision or something, and we open our hands, like pencils or pens or something like that. We don't lay them down. I used to notice at Tassara when I worked in the kitchen, people would take, people would take spoons and they slam them on the side of a pot to get the whatever off, you know?
The oatmeal.
Yeah, the oatmeal off, you know. Well, it's like that's a kind of disrespect for the objects. You know, you could do this or you could get another spoon and scrape it off. There are many things that you could do, but we have this kind of tendency to like, oh. So paying attention like that helps us to, it helps us integrate ourselves with and understand that we're in this interconnected world and that interconnection extends beyond the human realm. We like to anthropomorphize everything. But everything is not a human being. There's a quote that comes from, I think, the Lotus Sutra where I won't get this right, but it's talking about water. And, you know, it says that a human being sees water, cool water. But a rock might see something different. Or a hungry ghost in a hell realm, water becomes fire. You know, so each being has a different relationship to this world. Its perceptual relationships are different. But we tend to like want to make everything all the same, which is in our own eyes, right? Everything is as if it was only through our eyes. So we need to be careful about that. Yeah. You were going to say something.
That's interesting. My question is the middle path between the object and the human. It's about animals, responses to animals. We have one of our cats is very persistent, and she's just a cat, and jumping up on us all the time. And often I'm able to just to relocate her. I don't want her on my lap, just relocate her. Sometimes, though, it brings up a quick surge of anger, fling her away. And I'm curious as to the, as I introspectively try to figure, what is the source of that anger? Because I feel how it changes my body as well. You know, and it fortunately, it doesn't take me 2 hours to recover. But Is it? And I'm curious. Is it conditioning that I've had that I have to recognize, and then I can unravel that conditioning to not have that response, or is it more inherent in just the human condition that it's not something personally that I experience that generates this anger response?
I think you probably do it because you're getting something you don't want. That's one of the three things. There's Four Noble Truths. There is a suffering. There's a cause of suffering. Getting things that you, not getting what you do want, getting what you don't want, like cat in your lap. It sounds like a Dr. Seuss, right? And the third one is called re-becoming. So it's this way in which we reify our sense of self by telling a story, essentially, about who we are. Like what I was saying earlier about if you have some fixed notion about how things should be, it's actually you're reifying your sense of self. Because those thoughts that you have that make the world are actually thoughts you have about who you are. So it's, and technically it's talking about getting caught in the wheel of rebirth that we do because we have all this clinging and stuff and it pulls us into the next rebirth. So that's a situation where you don't want your cat on you. And you lose your patience because you've only taken the cat down 8 times, you know, and so you lose your patience once.
So my solution is really in the current moment. I don't need to spend my time thinking back in my past. What happened to me that is...
No, I wouldn't relate it to your childhood. I would just figure that, you know, it's like it's another opportunity to practice patience with your cat. And then maybe get in touch with a cat whisperer. I think that's the History Channel or something. That guy who comes into your house and fixes your animals when they're doing things you don't like. And they always say to you, you know, the reason this animal's doing this is because you, of something you're doing. It's never the animal's fault. So it's interesting. But yeah, just keep trying to practice patience as best you can.